busted flat in Baton Rouge, waiting for a train, and I was feeling near as faded as my jeans. Bobby thumbed a diesel down just before it rained, then rode us all the way to New Orleans. I pulled my harpoon out of my dirty red bandana. I was playing soft while Bobby sang the blues. Windshield wipers slapping time, I was holding Bobby's hand in mine. We sang every song that Javi knew. Freedom is just another word for nothing left to lose. Nothing, I mean nothing, hon, if it ain't free. And feeling good was easy, love, when he sang the blues. You know, feeling good was good enough for me. Good enough for me and my Bobby, yeah. From the Kentucky coal mine to the California sun, hey, Bobby shared the secrets of my soul. Through all kinds of weather, through everything we've done, your Bobby, baby, kept me from the whole world. One day of near Salinas long, I let him slip away. He's looking for that home, and I hope he finds it. But I train all of my tomorrows for one single yesterday, to be holding Bobby's body next to mine. Freedom is just another word for nothing left to lose. Nothing, that's all that Bobby left me. But if feeling good was easy, alone when he sang the blues. Hey, feeling good was good enough for me. Good enough for me and my Bobby, yeah.
Welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and you can hear us live at accesssacramento.org, or you can listen to this program and past programs at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com. Today's program includes about four different areas of discussion. The first one is Mark Hertzgard talks with Terrence McNally, who's a journalist and radio host. Mark Hertzgard is a fellow of the Open Society Institute the nation's environmental correspondent. He has also covered climate change for 20 years and is the author of 6 books, including most recently Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth. And then after that, from Living on Earth, The Cost of Coal. If the true cost of the full life cycle of coal were taken into account, this form of energy would be extremely expensive. In this program, they look into the extraction, processing, transportation, and combustion of coal that creates a large toll on the environment and human health. We also hear from poet and farmer Wendell Berry, who slept in the Kentucky governor's office to protest mountaintop removal. Host Bruce Gellerman also talks with Dr. Paul Epstein from Harvard University's Medical School about his new study measuring the true cost of coal. And then after that, the corruption game. Juan Cole, a professor of history and director of the Center for South Asian Studies at the University of Michigan, talks about U.S. government backing for corrupt dictatorships around the world. And after that, pressure cooking. Bill McKibben discusses the government's apathetic attitude towards global warming and that this forces the public to lead the fight against global warming.
Let me read first just a number that you throw out, and then I'm going to make a comment. Approximately 25% of the gross national product of the U.S. is at risk from extreme weather events, according to the American Meteorological Society and the American Geophysical Union. One thing that I have noticed is just in the last 2 or 3 days, talk in Los Angeles and headlines in Los Angeles newspapers, not about the fear of the big one being an earthquake, but the fear of the big one being some sort of flooding.
Wasn't that interesting? Yeah, that comes out of a new scientific study that was just released about a week ago. And they found historical evidence that this had happened once before. I think it was 1866 or something. And yeah, this is a threat here in California for flooding and drought. But I tell you that the sleeper that has really not gotten the attention it needs is what's going to happen to the Midwest, to the world's breadbasket there in Iowa and Nebraska and Kansas, where we grow so much corn and wheat and so forth. Corn in particular is extremely vulnerable to increases in temperature. And basically, if you get 3 days in a row of above 95 degree Fahrenheit, that spells the end of that corn. It cannot germinate and grow. And traditionally, I should say historically, Iowa has had one summer in 10 where that kind of an extreme weather event took place. By 2040, the scientists are projecting that they're going to have those kinds of summers in 3 to 4 summers out of 10. That is going to wreak havoc on food production and therefore food prices and threatens.
Let me ask you if you said that correctly, Mark, because the quote I have from your book is, during the 20th century, 3 straight days of 95 degrees once per decade. By 2040, 3 out of 4 summers with 3 days, not 3 out of 10.
All right. 3 out of 4.
Much worse.
Even worse.
Yeah.
Now, that's why it's important, you know, there are things that we can do to adapt to that, but technical fixes and such. But unfortunately, as that chapter goes on to describe, so many farmers, I think, in the Midwest, partly because many of them have both conservative political ideologies and, frankly, are listening to Fox News and getting their information from very dubious sources, that many of them are still doubting of climate.
Yeah, yeah.
So they're not taking the steps they need.
Let's talk just a little bit, because I want to make sure we cover this before we continue to talk about the victory. Let's talk about Cancun. And you began an article I read quoting a 21-year-old from Lebanon who said to ministers in Cancun, "You have been negotiating all of my life. You cannot tell me you need more time." So what was accomplished in Cancun? We just haven't spoken about it on this show, even though it happened in December.
Right, I thought that was an amazing comment from that young woman, because it's true, you know, the first discussions begin in 1988, and here it is 22 years later, and we're still not putting meaningful limits on. What did happen at Cancun, though, that is sort of mildly encouraging, is that a couple things. One, U.S. and China, the two climate change superpowers on Earth, The atmospherics of their relationship improved a lot compared to a year earlier at Copenhagen, where they were basically at each other's throats. And so that's, I think that can only be good. It didn't lead to any breakthroughs on emissions reductions, but hopefully it will before too long. But clearly the most important tangible accomplishment at Cancun was getting widespread agreement that the rich countries of the world, whose emissions caused global warming, will pay $100 billion a year to the poor countries who are going to bear the brunt of this to help those countries adapt and cope. And that's significant not just because of rich countries finally accepting their historical responsibility. It's also important because it signifies that the official climate debate is finally catching up with reality. And what my book Hot is about, that it's no longer just about stopping the emissions. We've got to work very hard and very quickly to put in place protections so that we can survive the enormous amount of climate change that is already locked in. And it is, again, it's going to hit, although it's going to be tough for us in the rich countries, it is going to be really tough in Bangladesh, in Peru, in many of the countries in Africa that simply don't have the money or the infrastructure or the technical expertise yet to deal with all the impacts that are lying in wait for them.
You know, I can't help but remember we've thrown around 88, 89, that sort of thing. In 1989, I remember participating in the mayor at the time, I assume it was Bradley, called a conference of to talk about the environment, and it was all municipal leaders of cities all over the world. So we had the rich and the poor countries, and that proposal that our number one proposal out of that conference was that the rich nations begin a process of monetary and technology transfer to the developing countries so that they could leapfrog us as they grew and be dealing already with the problems that they were going to face. And so finally we have an agreement to do that in 2010. One more thing about Cancun. So the good news is that the developing countries now have agreed that they must also limit, and they have been resisting that. The rich countries have agreed that they're going to send funds, and you mentioned that $100 billion a year, but that agreement, it starts at $30 billion over the next 3 years and grows to $100 billion a year by 2020. So it's a gradual push up to that. But are you troubled by the fact that Kyoto seems dead, and that was agreements to certain numbers? It looks like we're moving towards voluntary.
Well, I'm not sure of that yet. And let's, one quick note on the $100 billion, another cause for less than full-throated enthusiasm here, is that we still don't have firm commitments about where that $100 billion will come, that it will actually be new money rather than just a reshuffling of existing aid, which is what the rich countries have done in the past on this. So there's still a lot of loopholes in all of this. Cancun was by no means a, it only looks like a success compared to the
right, exactly.
Copenhagen. As far as Kyoto, I would say that on that front, that Cancun took a couple steps back from utter disaster, which looked like it was looming at the very start of Cancun, when Japan, of all countries, at the very start of the Cancun conference said, look, we are going to drop the Kyoto, our commitment to Kyoto. This is nonsense. And so that got a lot of play in the media for a while, but that was not included in the final agreement. And I think really what was going on, there was a bit of diplomatic poker playing.
Because mm-hmm.
essentially, the rest of the industrialized world, like Japan and Europe, are getting darn tired of the United States not stepping up to the plate. The United States is the only major industrial country that is still refusing to join the Kyoto Accords. And until the world's biggest carbon polluter, and we still are the biggest polluter, even more than China, contrary to what you often hear, until the United States steps up to the plate on this, the others are just saying, look, we're not going to do it. And I think Japan was basically sending that message, sort of a shot across the diplomatic bow
mm-hmm.
towards the United States in an effort to sort of shake the Obama administration off of its do-nothing posture.
Yeah, and, you know, as I've, bewailed many times, climate change, adaptation to peak oil, rebuilding of our infrastructure, both educational and physical, was one of those things that we darn well should have started during the boom, because right now it's going to be tougher for now and for the next few years. So in the U.S., the big legislative action last year was consideration of and no action on a cap and trade system. Can cap and trade, it's attacked by both the left and the right, can it succeed? And what about something like cap and auction or cap and dividend? And so start out by explaining to people what cap and trade is.
Yeah, there's a lot of different ways to do this. And I let's start the discussion by talking about we need a climate law. And that larger goal got renamed as cap and trade because a certain number of Democrats and major environmental groups got behind that particular policy instrument of cap and trade. But as you mentioned, there's many other ways to skin that cat. If the overall social goal is to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, you could also do it through a straight regulatory approach through the Environmental Protection Agency, which, of course, is one of the big fights we're going to see in the new Congress here as the Republicans try to basically block the EPA from regulating greenhouse gases. I think cap and trade, we've probably heard, frankly, the last of cap and trade because, as you say, both left and right hate it. It's been demonized now, rightly or wrongly. It was a market-based idea that essentially the government would put a cap on the total amount of emissions that a given industrial sector or corporation like, say, the electric utility industry, a cap on the total amount of emissions you're allowed to put into the atmosphere, and then the trading would take place among different companies in that industrial sector. If you, company A, could reduce your emissions much below that cap, you could sell your extra emissions to some other company, company B, that was not able to get those down. And the argument of proponents was that by doing this cap and trade system, you will bring the efficiencies and the incentives of a market-based economy towards reducing emissions. And there is some historical evidence that that can work. We saw it in the battle against acid rain.
Right, exactly. Let me say one of the things in favor of that model with greenhouse gases, unlike more localized pollution, is that what you can with greenhouse gases say that the burden for the whole world, or the burden for the whole country, or the burden for a whole state is shared because they aren't worse closer to a plant or closer to a freeway.
Yeah, that's true, but I think there's also these terrible drawbacks of it, especially, I mean, the timing, you almost feel sorry for the advocates of cap and trade, of which I am not one.
Because of the Wall Street meltdown.
Yeah, the Wall Street meltdown, and suddenly for everyone to see, you really want to put cap and trade, you really want to put the fight against climate change in the hands of financial speculators? Look what they did to the economy.
Exactly, and it's not just that you would put it in their hands, it's that you would take this real critical problem and make it about these sophisticated, it would become another place where they would invent, you know, these financial instruments, you know, akin to the credit default swaps and collateralized debt obligations and so on, and suddenly all the action would shift to that casino rather than the actual changes that need to be made.
Quite so, and that raises yet a third and arguably the biggest problem with cap and trade, is that it's too darn complicated to explain to voters or even to most members of Congress. If you have to spend that much time explaining it, we've just spent in the past few minutes,
yep,
you're not going to be able to sell it to the public. It's much easier to say, okay, we're going to tax carbon emissions and give the proceeds back to you, the citizen. All of you are going to get $1,000 a month, and you can use that to reduce your carbon emissions by, you know, investing in energy efficiency or not, as you choose. And that is the so-called cap and dividend approach. And I think that was politically far, far superior as a means of building public support for this idea.
And now it's interesting because you didn't merely say you think it's a better idea to solve the problem. You said you think it's better politically. And yet, am I correct in assuming then that the coming together of a lot of the major environmental groups and environmentally sensitive politicians around cap and trade was sort of finally rallying to, like, be a solution from 5 years ago?
Kind of, although they were, I think it was that, but it was also a reflection of the power of both market ideology in general and specific financial corporations on Capitol Hill, including with the Democratic Party and
yeah.
large environmental organizations. This was, they, you know, the enviros did not want to be seen as or open themselves to attack as, you want to regulate and tax,
yep.
that's all
yep.
you liberals want
yep.
to do.
Yep. So having said that, you believe the solution for the United States is a hard limit, fines, regulation, and yet we know that that was not what was attempted while there were Democratic majorities in both houses, and it will now face a House and a less so in the Senate, but definitely in the House. There are tough people who want to go backwards on all of this. When you say what we need is that law, what we need to happen is something which can be politically easily explained and so on, that isn't what you predict, is it?
Well, I'm an old-fashioned journalist. I try not to do predictions. I report what happens. But I can tell you that the goal in terms of policy has to be to limit emissions and specifically to put a price on carbon. And you can do that through regulation. You can do it through tax. You can do it through any number of policy instruments. And it is certainly true that the newly ascendant Republican majority in the House of Representatives in Washington is going to try to block all of that. And I think that the only way that we're going to see this kind of action coming out of the United States is, first of all, through the actions at the local and state level, including here in California. Let's remember, California is the eighth biggest economy in the world. And what we do here in California, because our economy is so large, has global implications. It's almost as important as what the federal government does. And you now have a situation where many of the states in the United States are way out ahead of Washington on this. And likewise with some of the big cities. There's a group called C40, which is 40 of the biggest cities around the world, like Los Angeles, New York, et cetera, San Francisco. And again, at that level, political leaders are very hip to this, and they are moving. So I think that is one very promising avenue. But nevertheless, you still do need change in Washington. And the only thing I'm convinced that will bring that is massive people power, massive popular pressure from below, just as we saw with most of the big challenges to the status quo in our nation's history, whether it was the fight for civil rights or to stop the war in Vietnam or what have you. If you stay with what the pundits say is politically realistic inside of Washington, you'll never get there. Washington politicians have to be made to fear popular pressure, and that if they don't do what the public is asking, they will be voted out. That's the only message that politicians understand.
Okay, we've got at this point a little under 15 minutes left. What I want to talk about is two things. One, your reasons for hope, and two, political action. And I think let's go to hope second. I'm going to read one quote again from the book, because despite all we've said, your book is hopeful. The most hopeful story I uncovered while researching this book was in Africa. The continent, scientists say, will be hit the hardest by climate change. To capture rainfall and rejuvenate soil fertility, illiterate farmers who did not know the term climate change were growing trees amid their fields of millet and sorghum. And despite enduring some of the hottest, driest weather on Earth, greenery has returned to more than 12.5 million acres of land. Underground water tables have risen. Crop yields have doubled and tripled. Tell a little more about that and other things you found around the world that give you hope.
Happiness.
More from great speeches and interviews after these messages.